On the August edition of Our Town, I thought it'd be nice to catch up with Chief Michael Schick over at Western Lane Fire and EMS Authority and his new deputy chief, Rob Chance. How are you both today?
Doing great. Thanks for having us.
Yeah.
Also doing great.
Yeah.
Thank you.
So, Matt House retired and you brought Rob in. What's Rob's kind of general, or should we let Rob answer that question? What's his general
duties? I better do it for
you. Better
him.
Start?
Yeah.
Okay.
So, Rob was my EMS chief and training chief. And then, Matt House, he's in the process of retiring. And it was a perfect opportunity. We had Rob in house. He's been doing great work with training and with EMS. So he's officially now the deputy chief. So he's taken over Matt's responsibilities. And he's still responsible for EMS and for training with us.
And Rob, have you worked side by side with Matt over the years? I mean, I know you kind of know each other because, like you mentioned earlier, you've been to my house. So I know you guys knew each other. What was that relationship? Or is that relationship?
Yeah, no, we've had a great relationship. He's been a great coworker, great mentor for me. We've worked together for the last 13 plus years, and I've had the opportunity to train and work with him in operations and as my previous role, training chief. I got to work with him in his role as deputy chief, so it's been great.
What is the biggest thing that you least expected to happen when you took over the responsibilities? As I see Chief laughing to himself,
you know, I wish there was more overlap in. I had more time, you never feel like you're ready to kind of just, jump into that role. But it's great. And of course, I have a great working relationship with Matt, and I can always just give him a call if I have any questions or anything. And he stops by the station still, he's still definitely a big part of the department. So that's great.
So the workload was a bit heavier than what you had previously.
A lot heavier.
Yeah. What does I've asked this Matt in the past, but what does a deputy chief, what is the responsibility aside from what you were doing prior to that?
Basically kind of doing everything that, chief needs me to do, running the department more or less. I'm in charge of, personnel and all the operations really, day to day and looking to the future and scheduling and just making sure that we're ready to go.
In the fire service, we consider a deputy position. They should be ready to take over that next step, that next higher step. So that's part of my job is to make sure that Rob, he's got all his assigned work, but then prepare him for that next step. I mean, to take over as chief someday.
Now, talk a little bit again about when Western Lane Fire and EMS Authority became the two separate entities, Western Lane Ambulance District and Suicide Valley Fire and Rescue, when they came together.
Right.
Did you then have what was two people into the one? Is that when Matt became deputy chief, that became one position over both?
Yeah. Initially, we had one assistant chief for the Western Lane Ambulance District and assistant chief for Sosa Valley Fire and Rescue. And the assistant chief for the fire department left. And so I just put Matt over both agencies since we were going in that direction. And then at that point, it just made sense to make it a deputy chief position.
So how are things going? I mean, Is finances and that been an issue, or is that coming together now with the money that comes in, or is it never really resolved?
But finances is always going to be an issue just in general for emergency responders. But as far as the integration of both agencies, that's pretty much complete. It's been very successful. We were working with the state of Oregon very closely to actually merge them into one entity. Right now, Western Lane Ambulance District and Sosa Valley Fire and Rescue still exist as separate entities.
So there's still two boards.
There's still two boards, and then they form the Western Lane Fire and EMS Authority Board. But Western Lane Ambulance District is a health district, and they're formed under certain Oregon statutes. And then the fire department, of course, is a fire district. And it turns out, it took us several years to figure this out, you can't merge a health district and a fire district. You can merge two fire districts or two health districts, but not a health district and a fire district. So we're pretty much in a position now where we'll stay status quo. We'll have the two entities. They have no employees. So Western Lane Fire and EMS Authority will still exist as it is now. All the employees are there. And then we have the Western Lane Fire and EMS Authority board members are from the Western Lane Ambulance District and the fire district. So it's working out pretty well. It's not where we want it to be, but the citizens won't see any difference. And I think we're providing the service that we wanted to provide.
If the possibility were there, would you still want to do it as one entity? I mean, is there something that you're, like I said, you're working with the state that could change that or bring that about, or is it?
It would be nice. It just, I mean, we have three budgets we have to do, and so it's just preparation and things along those lines. It's not bad to be three separate entities like that. It would just be easier overall. But I think, you know, personnel wouldn't see any difference. Citizens wouldn't see any difference. It just makes life a little bit easier if we were one entity instead of the three.
Does it make a difference in what's the word I want? Not logistics, but in the numbers, when you say how many calls are you out on, do you still keep separate numbers for both entities, or is it all considered?
It's all considered one, because both we get an ambulance and a fire truck on most calls, if not all calls. So it's really tough to separate it out, and we move personnel back and forth from an ambulance to a fire engine. Our medics, most of our medics are trained as firefighters, so it's real difficult to separate it out. So if you get a structure fire, you'll say, well, that's a fire department call. But there's an ambulance there providing support, EMS support. And on a medical call, if like a cardiac arrest, fire engine there, firefighters are helping with, you know, CPR, whatever else needs to be done. So it's very difficult to pull them out. So it's just, it makes more sense to us to just lump them all together.
Now, Rob, you're in charge of personnel. So what is the volunteer situation like right now? Are you guys in a drought for volunteers, or are you still getting folks coming in there wanting to do that role? Are you still training for those?
Yeah, I think we've seen the volunteer numbers decline over the last 5-10 years, you know, throughout the country. And so we're no different. Our volunteer numbers have definitely declined. I think we currently have, you know, less than 10 volunteers, which, you know, 5 years ago we had probably over 50. I think COVID had a big part in that, but we're always taking volunteers. You know, we're currently at the station right now. We're onboarding a brand new volunteer, which we're happy to have. So, you know, if people are willing to volunteer, you know, come on down and talk with me.
What is sort of the process and the prerequisites, physical, you know, needs and that for that kind of job?
So there are some, you know, we do have some physical requirements. We have a physical agility course that, you know, we put them all through, and we work with people if they're not in the best shape. And then we get them into our fire academy, where, you know, they're putting on gear, they're getting in the rigs, they're pulling hose, they're taking hydrants, throwing ladders. But you know, it is demanding. But that being said, you know, we even have some older folks who are, you know, who still do it. I think our oldest volunteer currently is well into his 60s. So, and we're happy to have him. He's one of our best volunteers.
Yeah, so it's a matter of how well you keep yourself, I guess, in that condition over time.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
The volunteer sort of schedule, is that sort of like whenever they can, or are they responsible to come up when a call happens, or how does that work?
So, you know, when we combined the agencies and we went to shift work primarily for our fire response, our volunteers started pulling shifts. So it used to be, you know, the pager goes off, they're at home, they respond to their station. Now they're actually just working shifts, either 12 or 24 hour shifts, just like they're one of our paid staff or part-time staff. You know, during surge events or when we have multiple calls going on, you know, we'll do second alarms or all calls for backfill. And, you know, absolutely, we have some of our volunteers that we're sitting at home and they'll go grab a rig. They'll come to our main station to be, you know, the next response up. So, you know, we have people that just come when the pager goes off, and then we have people that are working shifts, and you wouldn't be able to tell them apart. You know, they're no different. They look no different. They, you know, they perform no differently than any of our paid personnel.
How many houses are currently in use? So I know you got
stations.
You got the one behind the lake. I know there's two bay, or is it three bay there?
Three bay. So we probably have four stations that we're actively using. I mean, we have other stations that we store materials and apparatus, but we have two that we have our career responses. Station two, which is over at the hospital on hospital property. Station one, which is our main admin station on 101, and then four. Station four, which is north of town, and then stations five and eight, which are south of town.
Now, what about the Laurel? The one on Laurel there, or is that Laurel? I think it's Laurel Street, isn't it? The one next to City Hall?
Oh, City Hall. Oh, station. Yeah, that's pretty much used for storage during the summer months. We let ODF firefighters, Oregon Department of Forestry firefighters, stay there. So we have 24/7 coverage there from ODF, but that's just during the summer months. They didn't have any place for them to sleep. So we said, yeah, we've got room for them there.
So when you have these other locations, I'll mm-hmm. call them that, and you have rigs and stuff out there and stuff like that. What do you do if you don't get a lot of calls in a certain area? I guess you pull depending on how severe the issue is. So what's the maintenance schedule like? What keeps the trucks ready to go and the vehicles ready to go?
I have an excellent logistics chief, Andy Gray, who that's his job. That's his one of the things that he's looking at very closely and making sure that the vehicles are serviced properly, that they're run. We don't put a lot of mileage most of the time on our fire engines. Ambulances do get a lot of mileage. So you could have a fire apparatus that's 15, 20 years old with 10,000 miles on it. And that's tough on these engines just to be sitting there. So he makes sure they're running. They get tested annually, make sure the pumps are working, you know, up to standards. So it's a matter of, and then we try and rotate them.
I was going to ask you, like in station one, do you have a similar vehicle in another station that
exactly.
can take a place of one in station
yeah.
one?
Yeah.
Try to run them and keep, because I know that's thinking about keeping oil and keeping the motors running.
Right. And we've tried to transition our responses to smaller vehicles. We call them brush trucks. You'll see the smaller pickup truck.
Which you guys just got one recently, right?
The state, ordered us one. So that's the white one you'll see around town, and which was great. It was no cost to us, and they even paid for the maintenance. So that's been great. But we're trying to transition to a smaller vehicle, less costly, quicker to get on scenes. And so that helps to take some of the burden off our heavier vehicles.
In the outlying areas, when you get, say, a fire call or mm-hmm. a house fire or something like that, what are some of the most difficult things about being in the outlying areas? I would imagine water access.
Water's the big one. We're fortunate. City of Florence has a good water supply. Aceto Water does great. But then when you get outside there and south of the bridge, of course, we don't have hydrants. So we bring our own water with us. And that's – we anticipate we're going to have to use our own water no matter where we go, because you never know if there's going to be an issue with the hydrant. So we bring our own waters. We have water tenders. We have four water tenders, and we can bring a lot of water to a scene. So we anticipate that.
Now, recently, we had a fire up in Mapleton next to the railroad tracks there. Mm-hmm. Was that something that you responded to?
We did, yeah. And we pretty much will go on any fire, Mapleton, Swiss Home, Deadwood. They will request us in mutual aid, and we're happy to do that. But, yeah, we did respond to that.
What were the concerns with that one there? Because at first it seemed like it was going to be really bad, and then I don't know if it was still bad or it just seemed to get under control.
Weather conditions, it was dry, and we saw a lot of fire activity. We don't normally see that early in the season. Plus, Mapleton's water system, they have the storage tanks, which are just north of where the fire that was going. So we were very concerned that it was going to reach that area. Topography kept it closer to 126, which was nice.
And of course, with their critical water situation already, that didn't need to happen.
And then, of course, if you had a bad east wind, then it would have taken it right down 126. And
some other nature helps, too.
And I always say this about wildland fires, forest fires, is that it's always up to Mother Nature to put the fire out. We're just there to watch it for most of the time. But we can't fight a fire that has a lot of wind behind it. It's too dangerous, and it moves too fast. So it's Mother Nature that really does puts the fire out.
I don't know if, Rob, if you want to bring you in here, but what can you say to the misnomer that, we're the coast here. We're not really in that big a danger of, massive wildfire. What would you say to someone who says that?
I think that the weather's changing. I think that it's hard to deny global warming's happening anymore. But it might have been a few weeks before that I was out on a 15-acre wildfire out South Jetty Road. I don't know if you heard about that one. And that was definitely wind-driven. It was hard to get behind it. We're still green now, but we're definitely seeing fires, everywhere.
Well, and if you look as of this recording right now, we've had a really long stretch of no precipitation whatsoever. And even the mornings when you get that damp dew and stuff like that, mm-hmm. it's kind of been minimal, hasn't it?
And that's what we anticipated. Early predictions was this was going to be really bad in August, September for the state of Oregon and really the Pacific Northwest. And if you look at history around here, there's been some major fires on the coast. So it can happen. I think we're even drier than we were 100 years ago on the coast. So yeah, I think you have to expect that it could happen.
I mean, a couple of years back, you had that one down. Was it Gold Beach area? Was mm-hmm. it abandoned somewhere around there? Where that really bad one that got right up to the
water? There was one north of town, like Newport area.
There was one there, too,
City.
Never,
yeah.
Yeah.
But yeah, it can happen. People can notice how dry it is. And that's the thing here. It's just this grass dries out very quickly. The trees dry out very quickly.
Oh, yeah. Yards so, around here. You 1 minute you got this beautiful green grass, you know,
exactly.
in April.
Yeah.
And then by the end of May, it's like brown.
Yeah. So, and then it's windy all the time. That's the big thing for us is the wind.
Yeah. We hear the commercials on there about fire prevention and all that. And, you know, you hear about a trailer dragging its chains and that.
Sure.
Someone throwing out a cigarette. Are those really that high high possibility?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you look at the major causes of fire. Of course, you have lightning strikes. And typically, we don't see a lot of lightning strikes on the coast. We do, interior in Lane County. But human cause, cigarettes, any kind of spark. If you're out burning weeds and you get close to junipers, those will go up. It's just like gasoline there, green gasoline.
Well, I assume if you start a fire for something like that, or if you're camping, so I can always assume that those are major things. I just wondered if, because the cigarette, next thing you know, a little dry patch of grass and
It's not every time. It's just just takes the right conditions. The wind in the right spot. Like the Mapleton fire was some grinding. You had some metal sparks that were being sent off, and that's all it takes to get into right conditions, the right dry material, and with a little breeze, and then it just takes off.
I probably should ask law enforcement this, but is there an accountability for that grinding that was going on, or is there like a bill that gets mailed to how does that work?
We can bill for fire services that we provide. It depends on we wouldn't bill our citizens or anything like that that pay property tax, but we can bill outside. There is an investigation. I haven't heard anything recently on that, but that'll be Oregon Department of Forestry, who's responsible for that, and Lane County Sheriff's Office.
So going back to what I asked earlier about calls, how many are you seeing an increase in calls over time? Are they the health-related calls? Are they the fire-related calls? What are you seeing?
We're seeing more health-related calls, and it's a general increase over the years. And I watch that very closely as we, plan for
aging
the future.
Aging population,
I think, is the big one. And, of course, certain times of the year when you have influenza or COVID going around, then we get a lot of more breathing difficulties. And in the summer months, then we have, sand dunes accidents, which we're always worried about. But I think we are aging as a population, and we're seeing more aging-related calls.
Well, while I got you here, Rob, why don't you talk a little bit about, I know that June and July were a big push for LifeMed. How's that going? And, talk about how people can still sign up if they want to, how that works.
Sure. So, our LifeMed program, it's a great program. It covers any medically necessary EMS transports. So, somebody's having chest pain and we come, pick them up at home, and then we bring them to the hospital, and then maybe we take them to Riverbend or, Mackenzie Willamette or even Portland or something like that. That's all covered after we build insurance. So June, July are our big pushes, but it's open enrollment all year long. You just come on down to the station and speak with our admin and get you signed up and get you put in the books.
Are there any services that that the medics provide that are not charged for? Like if a person falls in their home and they can't get up, is that something that would be a charge, or is that something you guys come out and help this person? What are some of the things that might be?
We'll always come out and help. That's never an issue. We only charge if we transport. Mm-hmm. So a lot of we have, people fall.
So that would come under like the taxes we pay and everything that would come under that would fall under that?
It could, but that's how we look at it. Right. We want to make sure that everybody gets the help they need. But we wouldn't charge for that. And that is a pretty common call for us. Somebody's fallen and can't get up. They don't need to go to the hospital. Right. They just, for whatever reason, can't get up off the floor into their chair or into the bed.
Because I wondered how many people actually know about that. Because I have a family member, that falls every now and then. And, of course, he'll call us. Mm-hmm. We'll get him up. And that's great. We don't mind doing that. But I don't think that that's the first thought.
Right. We could be busy with, 911 calls at the time, but we'll get there as soon as possible. Mm-hmm. And we want to make sure that this is not a more serious issue. I mean, why are they falling? Are there a lot of trip hazards in the home? And we can send out, we have our mobile integrated healthcare paramedic that, she'll come out and evaluate the home, evaluate the patient. I mean, is there a medical reason that they're falling all the time, which is what we're concerned about. So we're more than happy to go out and help somebody that's falling, but we want to make sure that's fixing the problem,
right,
and not just prolonging issues.
Right. Yeah, and you're not repetitively going to the same place because they refuse or they didn't know to fix problems that existed.
Exactly. You know, is that the best use of a 911 ambulance? And, mm-hmm. and we're happy to help people, but we want to make sure they're getting the help they need.
All right. I think that about does it. I don't know that I have any more questions. Do you have anything you wanted to share with us that I might not have touched on?
Yeah, we've been doing. We've had 3 wildland deployments around the state, and one into California. So we're actively supporting, you know, our state and West Coast partners. We're doing that. So we send out.
Are some of those still out?
No, everybody is back right now. I know there is a large fire down in California, Southern California. I wouldn't be surprised if we get called to that. And we've had a lot of little fires within the state recently. And the state's being very proactive in moving resources there, which is fantastic. So the Oregon State Fire Marshal is doing a great job with that. So, yeah, we are sending out personnel. And we get reimbursed by the state when we do that. So it's very cost effective for us to do that. We just finished negotiations with our union that represents our personnel. We got a new contract and I appreciate everybody that worked so hard to get that contract done. It's a 3-year contract. And we are actively working to get our fire inspection program up and running. So a lot of the businesses in town and restaurants have started to see fire inspectors show up, which they haven't seen for a couple of years.
Yeah, since Tony left.
Yeah, and so it's again, we're here to help people, make sure they're safe, and we appreciate everybody working us along those lines. So we've been very active and getting out in the community and doing a lot, just not, you know, 911 calls, but there's a lot of other things we're doing as well.
You mentioned something that made me think of something else, too. Have you, Rob, ever been on one of the out-of-state calls? Have you ever been one of the folks that have been called to that?
I haven't been out of the state yet.
Okay, but you've been in the state?
Yeah, throughout the state. But
What's that look like? When you get the call and you're called to go down there, obviously you take a rig or two or something like that, or a tender or whatever it might be, and you go down there. Are you like waiting in line to go to work, or are you like put into work right away? What's the conditions like in one you've been on, let's just say?
Yeah, so we get the call, and so I would actually get the call, and then I figure out, you know, what resources they need, what kind of, you know, what type of fire engine, and then I figure out who's going, and usually we have to be out the door really quick. So the last call personally that I got to go on was, all right, you need to be out of town in 20 minutes. So you got to have your bag ready. You have to be self-sustaining for 72 hours. So we have to, you know, go and grab our food. And then your crew has to be able to self-sustain. And then we had to be down in Goshen. We had to, you know, within an hour and a half. And then you get briefed. And then when you show up on your assignment, again, there's more briefing. And usually they put you right to work. So most of the times when we head out, we get put on night duty. I know that every deployment, I believe this year, we're on the night shift and usually doing structural protection, just guarding houses while they, you know, do back burns and dozer work and stuff. So, we get put to work right away.
So what are the meals like? Do you take MREs or how do you allow for 72 hours? You don't go to Taco Bell, obviously.
Nope. It's a lot of PB&Js and granola bars and beef jerky.
Wow.
Yeah, just stuff, you know, that with a long shelf life and.
And they usually have, you know, food trucks up and running down there at the
right,
camp.
But you can't count on that when you leave.
Exactly. You got to be prepared. Yeah. You have to be prepared, absolutely.
That's cool. Yeah. Well, thank you both for being here. I appreciate it.
Thank you for having us.
It's always good to get an update. Love hearing about the great work you guys do and ladies too. So appreciate
your support. Absolutely.
Yeah, thank you.